Nature versus nurture is one of the oldest debates there is, but the answer might actually be neither. That's because researchers at Northwestern have found experiencing poverty actually has an effect on your DNA. It's been a tough few years for farmers who sell produce through CSAs, in part to more competition from big grocery stores and others cashing in on the local food market. How these farmers are adapting and what policymakers can do to help.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
All of that and more coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, how and why CSA farmers are having a hard time with their produce sales. But first, how much of your life is about your decisions and how much of it was already determined at birth? That's the nature versus nurture debate that's at the heart of many issues, whether we're talking about health, education, or economic mobility. Well, according to researchers at Northwestern University, the answer might actually be neither. That's because of the way the human genome works. And a new study shows that experiencing poverty can actually affect our genetic makeup. Thomas McDade is the lead author of this study. He's a professor of anthropology and a faculty fellow at Northwestern University's Institute for Policy Research. Kaylin Ryan was also part of the research team. He's a PhD candidate at Northwestern specializing in human biology and reproductive ecology. Both of them are on the line now from Evanston. Tom, Kaylin, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks pleasure for having
to be here.
Tom, I wonder if we can start with you. What made you interested in this topic?
Sure. Well, you know, broadly speaking, we know, and we have known for a long time, that that poverty sucks, right, in so many ways, but especially for your health. And people who have lower access to socioeconomic resources and the privileges it entails live shorter lives. And the lives that they live, they suffer from a wide range of diseases at higher rates, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, dementias, mental illnesses like depression, infectious diseases. And individuals at the extremes, the lowest of the income to the highest income distribution in the United States, it could be a 10 to 15 year difference in life expectancy across these groups. So we've known this for a long time. What we don't know is how it is that the experiences of socioeconomic adversity and poverty, particularly early in life, how these, to use a phrase in my line of research that we often use, how do these experiences get under the skin? At some level, these experiences have to shape our physiology. They have to shape function of our biology at the cellular level to have a lasting impact on our health. And we don't know how that happens. So the study was designed to address that question, and we were focusing on a category of regulation within cells that we term epigenetics. And epigenetics literally means epi, above the genome. And it's a class of biochemical processes that shape the structure of the genome. So we inherit genes from our parents. Those sequences are fixed at birth. But then lots of marks can get laid down on top of the genome that shape the structure and function of those genes, the likelihood that they get expressed. So epigenetics refers to a class of processes that change the activity of gene, but they actually don't change the sequence. And there's a lot of interest in public health and in anthropology and psychology and demography in this process as a potential biological mechanism that can link environments like poverty with health later in life. So that was the broad motivation for the study.
That makes a lot of sense. Kaylin, though, can you give us an example of epigenetics in terms of what we know about how that might change someone's genetic makeup?
So as Tom was saying, it doesn't technically change the genetic makeup, but if you look at the DNA, there's an example would be something called DNA methylation, and that's a tag that exists on the DNA, and you can think of it as sort of a switch that affects when and how the gene is expressed. And so when we look at those switches, we can sort of see differences. An example would be between tissue that has cancer and tissue that's healthy. there's a lot of these switches that start to turn and go in one direction or the other. And you can also see evidence of that with certain diseases, obesity or type 2 diabetes, for example.
Okay. So in that case, how did you, Kaylin, how did you guys even go about determining how poverty can have an epigenetic effect?
So what we did, this is part of a long-term study in Cebu in the Philippines, and in 2005, after, you know, lifelong information about the social and environmental context that people were living in, we were able to take blood samples from them. And in that blood, there's cells, and those cells have DNA in them. And so we can drill down into that DNA, technically speaking, and like find, you know, across the DNA those different marks. And then we can then attribute those to the nearby genes and start to understand what genes are getting switched on or switched off based on the social and economic environments that those people are experiencing.
And Tom, how long has this study been going on? You were following a group of people from what time period?
Yeah, the study was initiated in 1983, and it began with the recruitment of more than 3,000 women who are pregnant. They gave birth to their babies, and the moms and their babies have been followed up ever since. So it's a pretty incredible data resource for understanding how environments early in life and throughout the transition through childhood and adolescence, how they shape physiology and health later in life.
And so what did you guys find, Tom?
Well, we found that we found a very strong pattern of association between our measure of socioeconomic status, which was a composite of household income, assets, and education level in the household. That was a very strong predictor of the number of methylation sites across the genome that were methylated along the lines of the process that Kaylin was describing. So we found that more than 2,500 methylation sites were significantly predicted by the level of SES you had during your life, and that those 2,500 methylation sites were embedded in more than 1,500 genes across the genome. And that was quite surprising to us, the large number of methylation sites and the large number of genes that we found significantly associated with SES. You know, there were only about 20,000 genes in the human body. So rounding up a little bit, nearly 10% of the genes in the participants in our sample were associated significantly with socioeconomic status.
So just to understand what you're saying here, because it's a little technical, but basically you're saying your socioeconomic status can help determine the marks on your about 10% of our genetic makeup?
That's correct. So there's no association in our sample between the genes that these people inherited and their level of socioeconomic status. That's just random. But the level of socioeconomic status that they had in infancy and through their young adulthood predicted the level of methylation on 1,500 genes across the genome. So it along the lines of what Kaylin was saying, it influenced the switches of more than 2,500 switches across 1,500 genes in the genome of these participants.
And what kind of switches are we talking about here, Tom, in regards to what sorts of things?
Yeah, well, it's a large number of genes, right? It's 1,500. So broadly speaking, there are some biological themes that emerge, and they have to do with skeletal development of the nervous system, and the function and activation of the immune system. But it's hard for us to determine exactly what the downstream health effects of those associations will be, and that's something we're planning to do in the future by following these participants up. I think the key finding, though, and why this study is potentially significant, is that we find such a large number of hits across such a large swath of the genome. And that's commensurate with what we know about how socioeconomic status can shorten lives and impact a wide range of physiological systems and increase risk for a wide range of diseases. And so this study suggests that the impact of socioeconomic status is spread pretty far and wide across the genome. And that, I think, is potentially important.
We're speaking with Tom McDade, who's a professor of anthropology and a faculty fellow at Northwestern's Institute for Policy Research, and Kaylin Ryan, a PhD candidate in the Department of Anthropology, about their research looking at, as we've been talking about, this epigenetic layer and how these switches have changed depending on socioeconomic status in the group that they've been researching for almost 30 years at this point. It looks like you guys there are 30 years of data you've been looking at. Tom, were you surprised by these findings?
I was surprised. I was surprised that we got such a large number of associations. And to me, it's quite compelling. It challenges us to think a little bit differently about genetics and the genome. To me, it's really great evidence for the importance of the environment impacting how our genes are, how they function and how they're structured. You know, we tend to think of genes as inherited, fixed at conception, and somehow defining of our destinies. But this study and others in this area of epigenetics really force us to think of genes and the genome more broadly. Genes are literally, the structure and the function of our genes has literally changed in relation to experience over developmental time. And I think that changes the way we think about genes and how they might affect our health as well as other things we might care about.
Kaylin, I mentioned you're a PhD candidate. I wonder how this study has affected your research areas and what you're thinking about researching in the future.
That's a good question. Actually, I worked in non-human animals, and I became interested in this type of research, and particular in working with the Cebu population. It's a very rich data set, and there's a lot of questions we can ask that are pretty difficult to ask in humans. It's very hard to separate biology from the social world we live in. And Cebu is a good place to at least start to do that. And so this is kind of an important part of my development as a scientist and scholar in terms of thinking about what biology we do inherit and how does that interact with the world we live in. And so that's why I think this and some of the other things that we're involved in really start to challenge those old dichotomies of nature and nurture and the fact that a lot of this has the potential for having long-term implications for understanding our health and what inequality does for our health. Is really important.
Kaylin, do you think that even using the whole idea of nature versus nurture is even the wrong way to frame our thinking around genetics and poverty and health and other things?
I absolutely do. I think the nature versus nurture is sort of gone with the 20th century. I think I've heard people say nature via nurture. And other ways of interpreting these things, but there really isn't a clear boundary between what nature is and what nurture is that we can, the further you go down into the molecular world, the harder it gets to distinguish between one and the other because we are living organisms in a world that we interact with constantly, whether it's the microbiome or whether it's the food we eat or the pollution or toxins in the environment, everything affects our genes and everything affects our biology in some way.
That said, Tom, I wonder how policymakers should think about, particularly when we're thinking about poverty, if you think this should change the conversation a little bit.
Yeah, well, my hope is that studies like this provide further evidence for the fact that adversity, poverty, literally becomes embedded in our biologies, in this case in a deep way, in the genome, shaping the structure of our genes. And to me, that provides additional evidence that should mobilize support for policies that help reduce levels of poverty. That's outside my area of expertise to advise on exactly how to do that. But, you know, over the past 40 years, levels of income inequality in the United States have increased dramatically. And that was as a result of a series of policy decisions. So our current situation is not an inevitable one, and I think there are ways that we could hopefully reduce that that current trend. I do think it's important that we not use this kind of research to replace one sort of simplistic biological determinism with another one, right? And so there's a lot of emphasis on genes and DNA as destiny, as some causal force that is really important in our health. And this line of research has the potential to sort of replace one sort of determinism with another. And I think it's important to note that these kinds of factors, things leading to our health and how long we live, they are very complexly determined by multiple forces. So there's not going to be one silver bullet that solves all these problems, but I think we can all agree that anything we can do to improve the quality of environments and alleviate suffering associated with poverty, that would be a good thing in many dimensions.
And I wonder if this works in the inverse. Kaylin, Tom, like, do you feel like maybe there may be ways that our epigenetic layer, like we inherit things that are also really good for us as well?
Let me just finish this and Kaylin, you go. Epigenetic is a biological process through which our bodies experience the environment and take information in to shape the function of our physiological systems. That's important. Our bodies, we're born into this world, but we could be born into Evanston, downstate Illinois, or in Antarctica. And you want your body to be able to function as best as it can in different ecological settings based on the constraints and opportunities in those environments. Epigenetics is an important process through which our environments impact our genome and other aspects of our biology. So it's an essential process.
Yeah, Kaylin, we're almost out of time, but if you want to weigh in quickly.
No, I think Tom summed it up great. We're adapted to our world, and development and epigenetics are an important part of that, both good and bad.
So this is some new research out of Northwestern University, and we will tweet out some of the reporting as well as Northwestern's information about this study just published. Thomas McDade is the lead author. He's a professor of anthropology and a faculty fellow at Northwestern University's Institute for Policy Research. Kaylin Ryan, also part of that research team, a PhD candidate at Northwestern specializing in human biology and reproductive ecology. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In just a few weeks, many students attending four-year colleges will graduate, and in some ways, it's a good job market. The latest national unemployment numbers are at 3.8%. In Illinois, our jobless rate is about 4.3%, but it's also a mixed bag. You may know the U.S. has lost 5.5 million manufacturing jobs since 2000, for example. On the other hand, the federal government projects we'll see the biggest job growth in high-paying work like software development, as well as low-paying work like home care. Congressman Bill Foster has been thinking about these challenges and how we can prepare for them. He co-chairs a task force of Democratic House members focused on the future of work. I spoke with him shortly before an event at North Central College in Naperville on this very topic. We're also joined today by Kelly Hill. She's vice president of continuing education and advancement at Heartland Community College in Normal. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to be here.
Congressman Foster, we're speaking shortly before you're set to appear on a panel at North Central College in Naperville on the future of work. Obviously, this is a big topic, but when you think about this, how are you looking at a mindset of how we need to be preparing for how the labor market is changing?
Well, first off, I believe that all workers should have the opportunity to work and to make a good living for themselves and their families, and that includes their children. You know, it's no secret to anyone that technology is advancing at a breakneck speed. And the risk there is that machines will continue to exert downward pressure on wages. You know, this is not news to farmers who've had the mechanization of farming, you know, put downward pressure on grain prices for generations now. You can see it's caused tremendous anxiety in Rust Belt factory towns, where even if the factory remains as it always has, the degree of automation in them means the number of good-paying jobs has dropped tremendously. What's new now is that a lot of this is moving upscale, that you're seeing people with master's degrees in finance being displaced by artificial intelligence algorithms and so on. And so this is a problem that's not going to go away. And I found that educators in particular are very keyed into this issue. They have a very difficult job of trying to figure out what training kids should receive today for the jobs that will be there 20, 30, or 50 years from now. And that's what I think everyone is struggling with. And I've also found that the students are very plugged into this issue, too. You know, we've had, I guess, 3 town halls on this issue. You know, one of them on technology down at Lewis University, another one on apprenticeships at the IBEW Hall, and then this third one at North Central College. And kids are also interested in their future and looking, even in their brief exposure to technology, have seen things change a lot.
Yeah, well, I wonder what do they say to you, Congressman, about what they want you to do?
Well, part of it is they ask advice, which is probably the hardest thing to answer. I think, above all, people have to remain flexible, that you're not going to ever again be in a situation where you get one set of training and spend your entire life. Even if you decide that you're going to be a doctor, what a doctor will do on a day-to-day basis, 20 years from now may be very different than what a doctor does today, just because the advances in technology. And so everyone has to stay flexible. It's also important, I believe, to continue to invest in what are sometimes called the soft skills, critical thinking, creativity, and interpersonal skills, because those will be valuable no matter what the future brings from a technological point of view.
That's Representative Bill Foster. He's a Democrat representing Illinois' 11th district, includes some of Chicago's southwest suburbs. A former physicist, we haven't asked you about your training, Representative Foster, but Kelly Hill is also with us with Heartland Community College. And Kelly, to the congressman's point about flexibility, how much do you think community colleges, and in particular Heartland, you all are more positioned to be maybe a little more flexible? I think when you think about four-year institutions, I don't think flexibility is frankly a word that ever comes to mind when we think about adapting curriculum. But how about you guys at the community college level?
Well, we really do pride ourselves in having that ability to be nimble. Really, community colleges are centrally situated between K-12 and the four-year universities that you just talked about, as well as our unions, labor unions, and employers. We really serve the whole community. So we have to be pretty nimble because we meet the needs of so many different constituents.
And when you're thinking about Normal, Kelly, and we're thinking about Heartland Community College, I wonder how much of your focus is on advanced manufacturing. I'm thinking about Rivian, other companies like that that have moved into your town recently. How much are you trying to prepare students to go into new modern manufacturing jobs?
Absolutely. We, in fact, just started recently a new Office of Pathways and Work-Ready Programs. We have ongoing meetings with leadership at Rivian and some of our other emerging manufacturers. Brandt Industries just started here, and so we've had a lot of conversations already with them, have toured their plants. I mean, we really try to get our leadership as well as our faculty and our instructors through those plants and in early conversations so we understand exactly where we're headed with student needs, and we're always trying to pivot to meet those needs.
And when you're thinking about pivoting, apart from manufacturing, I mentioned, for example, home care, how much your growth will see in those sorts of jobs. I'm thinking CNAs or home health care aides. Where do you see Heartland in terms of the need for students? What other industries are you looking at?
Well, you just mentioned healthcare. That's a big one for us. We actually have what we call work-ready programs, and that those kind of run the gamut. Anything from, you know, some degrees help students upon successful completion to directly enter the workforce. So like a nursing degree, we can give an associate's degree, and that kind of is a little bit of a gray area because, yes, they can enter the workforce directly from nursing, or they can, we have a nice partnership at Heartland here with Illinois State University, and our students can go directly then into their four-year bachelor's program. But when we talk about work-ready, we really are focusing more on shorter-term programs that are anywhere from 4 weeks to typically 3 terms or 18 months. And those have industry-recognized certificates or a certification or a college certificate, and many of those are short-term. So one thing we're really working on there is making sure students have some stackable credentials so they do have options in a different pathway. So healthcare, we just talked about. For instance, someone can come here and go through a phlebotomy program, and they can go directly to work. In fact, we have great success rate. Almost all of our phlebotomists get snatched up right away by our hospitals in the lab situations. But if an individual decides they want to come back and pursue something a little more robust like medical assistant, they can bring that phlebotomy expertise, actually get stackable credit for it in the medical assistant program. So we have to look at things industry by industry, occupation by occupation, and make sure we're always making those changes so students have options, but they're also definitely employable when they step out of that pathway and when they want to come back into a pathway.
Congressman Foster, as you're listening to Kelly discuss, for example, healthcare, and that's another area of field where we see a lot of growth, and maybe I think when we talk about jobs and the future of work, we tend to focus on the jobs that are going to be high-paying, whether those are science or advanced manufacturing or STEM education. But what about when it comes to healthcare and other jobs that are maybe when we look at, for example, BLS predictions, we're not just looking at new software engineers, but we're also looking at jobs in fast food, personal care aides, nursing. I wonder if we talk enough about the other end of the income spectrum.
Well, also a lot of the nature of jobs will change a lot. For example, I was at the Mori Corporation, which was an 85-year-old manufacturer of electronics, including very leading-edge automated assembly lines. And they said the jobs they have trouble filling are things that they used to call programmers. But these are people that instead of writing code, simply set up the machines and set tolerances and read through the manuals and understand how this very advanced machine vision, some of it with artificial intelligence inside it, how you give that the directions to do the job it has to do on the assembly line and then readjust it and give it new instructions on a day-to-day basis. So these are jobs that are classified as programmers, but actually they're almost users of artificial intelligence. And so the skills you need are very different. I spend a certain amount of my time just trying to keep my skills up to snuff. For example, you know, back in the 1990s when I worked at Fermi National Accelerator Lab, we used artificial intelligence to analyze particle physics interactions. And the algorithms there are not very different than the ones that are being used today for all these revolutionary advances in artificial intelligence. But instead of being programmed in Fortran, they're programmed in languages like TensorFlow and Python. The need to retrain yourself, even when you're already an expert, is something that is not going to slow down. And this will happen across the spectrum of work. For example, if you're in home health care, a big part of what you'll be doing is explaining to people that need home health care how they use the latest technologies to monitor their health, teach them how to use, you know, Fitbits and monitoring devices, how they interact with various artificial intelligence agents that are going to be in their home, asking them how they feel and what sort of help they might need today. These are things that, you know, a normal human being comes with some but not all the skills they need to proceed. And so it's going to be a wild ride trying to make sure our workforce tracks the workplace of the future.
Kelly, this is something you obviously, you and Representative Foster spend a lot of time being immersed in this, thinking about this, talking to people about this. For those of us who aren't in this, whether we're thinking of people who know young people who are entering the workforce, maybe there are people who are listening who might be entering the workforce or parents of those young people, how should we be thinking about this? Or I'm even thinking about parents of high school students who are thinking about what they want to do next. How do you think is the best way to go about thinking about how our work will change in the future?
We want to really make sure a couple things are happening. So one, Congressman Foster talked a little bit earlier about what are sometimes called soft skills. At Heartland Community College, for example, we have essential competencies, and those are embedded, core competencies embedded in all of our educational programs. So the five areas are communication, problem solving and critical thinking, diversity, ethical and social responsibility, and technology. So we want to make sure they have those essential competencies because those are going to come up even if a student doesn't know what they want to do right now, or even if what they end up doing in 20 or 30 years oftentimes doesn't even exist now. We don't even know what that is. So that's one thing we want to think about to make sure students do have flexible options. But you also talked about some of the lower paying jobs, and you know, sometimes we need to understand that might really be the best choice for somebody right now. And so if I use the example of phlebotomy that stacks back into some of the other healthcare career tracks, they can come back and bring that experience and that credential back in. A student who finishes the phlebotomy program can go to work, for example, at a hospital. And while they may be only be making $12 an hour or something, they are earning benefits that are needed right now. And they also might find out that they love healthcare, or they might find out that's not really what they like. So there's a value to just kind of dipping your toe into something that's maybe shorter term. Maybe it doesn't earn the wages right now that an individual eventually wants. But there are other benefits like healthcare benefits. And also, a lot of times, some of those bigger employers, like some of our hospitals, have employer tuition reimbursement so that student can come back later and further
right.
their
maybe have their nursing degrees and things like that paid for.
Absolutely, go back into something a little higher paying.
Representative Foster, when you're thinking about Illinois colleges, community colleges and universities, what would you like to see us doing better? Is it communication with employers? Is it between four-year and two-year institutions? What do you think needs to be improved?
Well, I think communication with employers is the first line of defense. Some of our community colleges and apprenticeship programs and the like, they're really on the front lines of that. I think in terms of kids, they should really cast a wide net in terms of what their interests are. Probably if you think back 10 or 15 years, we were saying, okay, the World Wide Web is the future of everything, so let's teach all our kids how to code in HTML. Okay, and so this whole generation of people could code in HTML. And now no one uses HTML anymore. On the other hand, we have 2 billion web page maintainers who simply maintain their Facebook page. And so one of the features of advancing technology is that it becomes easier and easier to use. Another feature is that the benefits of being super rich actually are getting smaller. I was very struck with the observation that if you are a middle-class person in the United States today, you can buy as good an iPhone as anyone could buy. The richest billionaire cannot buy a better iPhone. And this has to do with one of the democratizing aspects of technology. Once you've developed a wonderful product, you can deploy it to everyone for very low costs. And this is one of the reasons why it may be a mistake to focus too much on the starting salary and a little more on the ability to do something that you like and to interact with people that make you satisfied with what you're doing. Because I think it may become less and less about the number of dollars that you take home each week and a little bit more about your quality of life.
That said, I wonder, Representative Foster, what policies at the federal level you think we should be working on, policies that could have bipartisan support to help continue to foster good economic policy at the state level?
If you look at one of the big stresses, particularly on rural communities, it's the cost of health care and the difficulty of deploying health care in areas with low population densities. that's an area where, for example, technology is going to help tremendously. You'll be able to have, you know, drone deliveries of drugs to people that need them in short order. It will make telemedicine, for example, will make it much less expensive to deliver health care to rural areas. And that will make it more reasonable for people to stay there, for factories to move back into rural areas where they may have left, because the workforce there will be less driven to the cities because of the democratization of technology as it spreads out into rural areas. Things like rural broadband are at the top of everyone's list for what we have to deploy quickly.
Representative Bill Foster is a Democrat from Illinois' 11th District, which includes some of Chicago's southwest suburbs, including Aurora, Naperville, and Joliet. Kelly Hill is the Vice President of Continuing Education and Advancement at Heartland Community College in Normal. Representative Foster, Kelly Hill, thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We are in the middle of spring, even though it did snow this weekend, if you did not notice. This time of year, though, if you bought shares from a community-supported agriculture or CSA farm, you're likely to be getting your fresh produce on a regular basis soon. CSAs allow consumers to buy produce directly from small farmers, but times are actually pretty hard for CSA farmers. The market's gotten a lot tougher in the past few years, and that's led CSA farmers to try to adapt in order to stay competitive. So we've gathered a couple folks to talk about this. Shay Balahi is one of those farmers. She's a part owner and farm manager of Blue Moon Farm in Urbana and in studio with me now. Hi, Shay. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Simon Huntley's also on with us. He's the founder and CEO of Harvey. That's a company that helps small farms with marketing and technology. Hi, Simon. Thanks for being here, too.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, Shay, you first started this farm about you started your own farm 7 years ago, and you've been with Blue Moon Farm since 2015. Choosing to go into farming is itself, I imagine, a pretty big decision. But why did you want to work on a CSA farm specifically?
So actually, when I joined Blue Moon Farm, they weren't a CSA farm. It was a program that I helped implement when I moved there. But I really like connecting directly with my customers and establishing a relationship, and find that that's the best way to help build community.
Mm-hmm. And so you brought some carrots with you today that look beautiful. What are you guys growing right now?
Right now, we are mostly growing inside of our greenhouses, which helps us be year-round. We've got spinach and salad mix, baby bok choy, some baby kale, some big kale, Swiss chard, collard greens, and we've got a lot of brassicas that we've planted by hand out in the field.
So I wonder how it's different if running a CSA farm versus a traditional farm, where you are, and I imagine there are some farmers who probably do both, right?
That's right. Yeah. So, yeah, CSA farm is a little bit different in that you have to plan to have something reliably for several different people every week. So you need a steady influx of product to supply to your consumers.
And how have the past few years been for you guys and for your business?
Pretty, you know, they're changing. It's changing overall for our farm. But we're doing pretty good. We're staying relative in the market, and we're staying connected with our community, which we find is the best way to stay within giving produce to our community is direct to the consumer.
And are you finding there are more competitors in your space now?
Definitely. The market has changed for sure. We're noticing a lot of bigger grocery stores that offer organics where before it wasn't as widely available. And the convenience factor changes how the market works for sure.
Mm. Simon, I wonder if you could explain a little bit more. You work with not just Shay, but other CSA farms across the country. Are we seeing this across the country increase competition in the local food market, essentially?
Yeah, it's definitely happening across the country, and Harvey has been developed by my company to help farms address these changes. And I really started to notice it 4, 5, 6 years ago. Certainly when I started being involved in CSA farms and the early 2000s, this is really the only game in town as far as getting local, sometimes organic, not always organic, but produce. And so that has really changed in the last 10, 15 years. And we're seeing that effect on our farms.
So what are the biggest challenges that farmers are telling you they need help with, Simon?
We just, it's really about keeping members year over year. So that's one thing that we look at is how farms can have really good retention rates and how can they make their customers happy. I mean, oftentimes they're growing great produce, right? And they have this great connection. Shea does a really good job of connecting to her community members. And so this is really a special thing that's out there. Like there's no, you're not going to get this at a grocery store. You're not going to get that connection to your farmer at the grocery store, but through a CSA farm or a farm share, you can do that. And so we just put a couple tools on top of that to make it customizable, nice payment plans, really good support, recipes, things like this. So we put this, you know, just make it a little bit more customer friendly and let the farms do what they do. And they're really succeeding with it.
Mm-hmm. So, Shea, you introduced us to Simon and to Harvey. What has Harvey done to help you guys?
Harvey's really been amazing to help us with the technology aspect, making it easy for our customers to sign up. But even better than that, it's allowing us to offer fully customized boxes to our consumers, to our customers, our farm shareholders. Over the last few years, when we reintroduced our CSA program on our farm, most of the feedback that we got from our customers is that they wanted more flexibility in what they got in their boxes. So the thing that Harvey does is allows every single customer to go in and rate all of our vegetables on a scale from 0 to 5 or 1 to 5 based on how much they like it. And then Simon's created this algorithm in the background that creates a box for the customers every week based on what they like. So they're not forced to eat beets if they don't like beets.
Which is kind of always, I would say, the common refrain with the CSA is when people get a box and there's stuff in there that either they don't know what to do with or they don't like.
Exactly. And Harvey also supplies recipes. So if you're stuck, you know, you've had tomato soup for the 1,000th time, you want a new way to use tomatoes, Harvey provides recipes for every box that is made for each customer.
And is that harder for you if you're customizing? Is that a challenge for you in terms of the growing side?
It is a little bit more challenging, but not really. We are really diverse on our farm and we have a lot of different products. So we're able to put limits on, you know, if we only have 20 pounds of arugula, we can put a limit on that. And so it does make it a little bit easier and it adds additional challenges in different ways.
Mm, right. It sounds like so probably a lot of things you did not think you would be doing when you were getting into farming, right?
Yeah.
We're speaking with Shea Balahi with Blue Moon Farms in Urbana. Simon Huntley's on the line, founder and CEO of Harvey. That's a company that helps smaller farms with marketing and technology. And I want to introduce Guillermo Payet, founder and president of Local Harvest. That's a website and database for CSAs and for farmers markets. He's based in California in Santa Cruz. Hi, Guillermo. Thanks for being with us, too. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, Guillermo, I wonder if you can respond to something Simon said about how kind of the competitive edge that CSAs have is thinking this is a chance for you to know your farmer. But I'm thinking about grocery stores now where they have people coming in and this is like a meet the farmer event. And they're trying to also, I think there's in the grocery store space, everyone is kind of recognizing the narrative and wanting to capitalize on people knowing their farmer. Are you seeing this happen all across the country that CSA farmers are having to compete with at this level?
Yes. We work with about 7,000 CSAs in the country, Local Harvest. We have a few hundred that use our CSA Aware service, which is a competitor to Harvey. And what we've seen also in the last few years is about 40% decline on the size of the CSA market. The entire CSA market maybe 5 years ago was around $400 million a year, not very big. Now, I think that the problem for CSAs is not so much the local grocery chains, which, I mean, they are actually kind of a little bit of a marketing venue where people can see the produce for a particular farm, and then if they know about the CSA from that farm, they can subscribe directly. But the main problem has been the meal kit companies. The meal kit companies.
So this is like the HelloFresh, Blue Apron, all of those kind of things.
Right.
Okay.
Those companies, their current market is about $1 billion a year. That's like three times as big as CSAs are right now, or more. And now they're doing that at a loss. Blue Apron was losing $100 million a quarter a year ago. Now they've managed to cut that down to something like $20 million a quarter, which is still pretty bad. I mean, they're losing money like crazy, but competing with CSAs. I mean, their whole marketing is very farmy, right? It's like they were created to capitalize on the CSA space that small farms had created. So that is the main thing that is hurting the small farms right now, the CSA farms. I mean, we've seen in Illinois, we work with 152 currently active CSAs in Illinois, in Local Harvest. The average share size is 65 subscribers, so it's not a big market, but still we've seen, at least we know of 8 CSAs that have gone under in Illinois in the last couple of years.
Mm. Shay, I wonder if it's frustrating for you as a farmer to hear what Guillermo is talking about. You're talking about building community and wanting people to be connected with you as a local farmer, but then you maybe seeing people who have interest in cooking their own food finally, but they're buying it from this big company that's obviously not a local company.
Yeah, so I think we kind of look at those. I mean, as he said, they're losing money. They're not sustainable. They can't keep working at a loss.
They're just trying to capture your market share.
Exactly. The thing that we are benefiting from Blue Apron and HelloFresh is that people are learning to cook again, and their retention rate isn't that great. So what it does is it helps people get familiar with new vegetables and new things and be able to cook. And then once people fall out of that that HelloFresh or Blue Apron thing, it's easier for them to transition to CSAs, get the product, and be able to use it in a similar way, probably at a much cheaper cost. And there's a lot of waste. Plastic waste that goes on with Blue Apron and CSAs, we're able to limit that waste, which is a benefit that we have.
So when we think about that, Simon, how are you working with folks like Shay? I wonder what advice you have for other people in terms of trying to stay competitive and stay afloat in this space.
Yeah, it's tough. I think what Guillermo's saying about these meal kit companies, very true. One thing that I noted is that I think this has gone down a little bit, but Blue Apron was willing to spend $144 on marketing to acquire a single customer. And this was at the time when they went public. So one of the things I see as a problem within our sort of local farming community is that we don't really market ourselves really well. I mean, we have this great product, you know, that people really want. People do really want to support local farms. They want this really fresh product, but I think in many cases, people don't even know that these programs even exist. So I think that we need to get better at marketing within our community.
Right. And obviously, Shay, you are farming, so marketing is like a whole other job. Guillermo, I wonder what you want people to know about CSAs as we're thinking about the spring and as we've been having this conversation. What do you want listeners and consumers to know?
Well, my hope is that eventually we're going to go back to the slow organic growth on the space that we used to have until 5 years ago. That would happen when this food 2.0.com bubble that we're seeing right now pops, which I think eventually will. Now what we're seeing right now in terms of like farms that are doing well, I mean, we see a lot of farms that are shrinking in the size of their CSA, but we do work with a few that we see that they're growing. And the two main things that we see on those is some are competing with the meal kit companies in terms of all the bells and whistles, convenience, customizability, all these things. And we provide the tools to do that as well. But then also we're seeing that a lot of CSAs are really retaining their markets really well or growing. Some are growing by just focusing on community, like Blue Moon. They bring up the idea and refresh that to their members that they are part of a food shed, that of a food community. It's not just buying food.
Right, it's not just the transaction of this, right, Shay? And that's what you said about the whole idea of community when we're thinking about Blue Moon Farms. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank Shay Balahi for being with me with Blue Moon Farms, Simon Huntley with Harvey, and Guillermo Pyatt with Local Harvest. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Before we go today,
for fiction, the prize is awarded to The Overstory by Richard Powers, an ingeniously structured narrative that branches and canopies like the trees at the core of the story, whose wonder and connectivity echo those of the humans living amongst them.
That was Dana Kennedy, administrator of the Pulitzer Prize, announcing the award for fiction just yesterday in New York, as you heard. This year's winner, Richard Powers, for his book, The Overstory. The novel tells the story of nine Americans and their unique connection to the world's forests. And we've got an Illinois connection to Richard. He's an Evanston native and a professor emeritus at the University of Illinois. Congratulations again, Professor Powers. That does it for us today. You can always find more information about the 21st at 21stshow.org. Past shows, if you want to send us feedback, head to 21stshow.org. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.